It's Philosophy Talk.
Some unelected activist judge has rejected stop and frisk on the bizarre theory that minorities have a constitutional right not to be stopped at random and manhandled by strangers.
Isn't racial profiling just an expression of our implicit biases? It's human nature to react to new objects on the basis of visible traits and past experiences.
The program is not about color. It's about friskability.
Even the most liberal, left-leaning, free-thinking, non-racist people suffer from implicit biases.
I don't see color, not even my own. People tell me I'm white, and I believe them because I don't get frisked.
Our guest is Linda Alcorn, author of Visible Identities, Race, Gender, and the Self.
You might be the only person in the galaxy who was able to imagine a raceless human being.
Racial profiling and implicit bias, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Thank you for listening to this week's free stream.
Philosophy Talk is made possible through donations from listeners like you, and we need your support now more than ever.
Please head over to philosophytalk.org/benefits to learn more. You can become a member of the community of thinkers at various different levels.
Help us stay on the air and online
while getting the most out of Philosophy Talk.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And most of all, thank you for donating. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Janan Ismail, sitting in today for John Perry, who's out of the country.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford, where Ken is a professor of philosophy.
And where Janan is visiting, working on a book at the Center for Advanced Study in Behavioral Sciences. She, too, is a professor of philosophy from the University of Arizona.
Go Cats! Today we're talking about racial profiling and implicit bias.
You know, Janan, I hate racial profiling. I hate it when police single out random people for suspicion based on nothing but their appearance, their ethnicity, their race, their national origin. It's a terrible practice.
Not surprised to hear that, Ken. But I'm curious, what is it that you object to? Is it the racial part or the profiling part?
Well, it's obviously the racial part. I can imagine that criminal profiling of a sort is a useful tool for law enforcement. You ever watch the TV show Bones?
Yeah.
I love that show. And I especially love the character Sweets. He's a profiler, but he's a scientific profiler. He comes up with these really detailed profiles to help them solve all these crimes. They're based on all kinds of things. Race may be a consideration, personality traits, the sound of the voice when the guy's talking about the crime, his relationship to the victim. It's cool and it's scientific, unlike your ordinary racial profiling.
So race is just one of the factors in a complex profile. You think that's legitimate. But when it's the only factor, somehow that makes it problematic?
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Okay, so would any police profile that relied on a single factor be problematic in the same way? Or is it just race?
I'm not sure I'm following you.
Well, what about gender? With certain crimes, especially violent ones, we automatically assume that they're committed by men. I know, for example, if I'm walking down the street at night and I see a group of men and a group of women, I'm probably not going to be afraid of the women, but I might be expected, appropriately so, to cross the street to avoid the group of men.
I get your point. I see a certain wisdom of that. I would probably recommend to my wife or my daughter that they do the same, but I think you're trying to lay a trap for me here, Janan. You're trying to get me to say, well, if it's legitimate to be more wary of someone simply because they're male, well, why not because they're black or Latino or Middle Eastern? That's what you're trying to get me to say, right?
Exactly. It's not that there's only a single factor that makes racial profiling questionable. It's something else. So let me ask you another question. If we didn't live in a racist society, would you still have a problem with racial profiling?
Oh, come on, Janan. There wouldn't be any racial profiling if we didn't live in a racist society. Racial profiling is nothing but our deeply rooted stereotypes and prejudice being triggered by the other. That's the problem with it. It's just a form of racism in action.
Really? That's an awfully strong claim, Ken.
Well, yeah, it's a strong claim, but you know what? It's true. I mean, it's borne out by experience. Think about Trayvon Martin or Michael Brown or hundreds of others I could name. Why were they gunned down, Janan? They were gunned down simply for being wild black. That was their crime.
Look, I'm certainly not trying to defend abusive police practices, but I'm still wondering what exactly you think the problem with racial profiling is. Is it that it's a symptom of a racist society? Is it that it reinforces racist institutions? Or is it something different? The reason needs to be articulated because it makes a difference to how the problem gets addressed.
I take your point. And, you know, one of the things that makes it so hard is that people are unaware of what they're doing when they do this. You know, that police officer who pulls over a black guy driving in a rich white neighborhood because he looks, well, out of place. And he may not think he's being racist. He may think, well, he's got these good antennae. He's been at this for years, and he knows how to identify a suspicious-looking character. But really, really, it's just his implicit biases being triggered by the other, the black other. That's all it is.
So you make it, when you put it that way, you make it sound like a bad thing.
Well, it is a bad thing, Janann.
But isn't so much of how we all read other people done unconsciously as a matter of necessity? It's not just police. So think of a doctor. An experienced doctor can be expected to have finely tuned instincts for recognizing subtle cues that he's seen before, built up on the basis of years of experience. So what's the difference between these kinds of educated gut instincts and what you're calling implicit bias?
Well, for one thing, I trust my gut. I probably trust your gut, too. And as you suggest, gut instincts can be educated by real experience. But an implicit bias, that's just when a culturally induced stereotype is triggered by the black other or the Hispanic other. It's not based on any real information. It's just ignorant prejudice in action.
Good. Now I feel like we've got something to sink our teeth into it. What precisely is implicit bias?
And to give us even more to chew on, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Natalie Jones, to investigate the widespread tendency to racially profile. She files this report.
I define racial profiling as the use by law enforcement officials of race or ethnicity or national origin or any similar kind of construct as a basis for suspicion.
Jack Glazer teaches psychology at UC Berkeley's School of Public Policy, where he focuses on prejudice and stereotyping. He approaches his research with the idea that law enforcement officers are just regular people doing a difficult job, and sometimes their personal biases get in the way. Racial profiling happens when those biases take over.
In order to make snap judgments about who should be investigated, they rely on thoughts in their heads. And some of those thoughts are, and some of the most prevalent thoughts are stereotypes associating blacks in particular and Latinos with crime and aggression.
The debate over racial profiling in America was reignited with the Trayvon Martin case and the uproar over stand your ground laws. Now, another law is coming under intense national scrutiny, and that is stop and frisk.
With policies like New York City's stop and frisk, race isn't explicitly part of the practice. But people get worried when laws or policies seem like they might make it easier to target a certain group and harass innocent people.
All of the officers out there and their supervisors, I think, sincerely are opposed to the idea of racial profiling, so there's already a de facto ban on it.
We're going to continue to do our job. I'm confident that law enforcement will not racial profile like I've been accused of.
That's Joe Arpaio, sheriff of Maricopa County, Arizona, whose office was found guilty of racial profiling by the Justice Department in 2011.
It's really a question of how do you prevent people from doing it, since it's normal human cognition.
But not everyone is necessarily against profiling. In a recent Rasmussen poll, 49% of respondents said profiling is necessary in today's environment. And public figures sometimes come out as proponents.
The radical Muslims are the people that are committing these crimes, as we've by and large, as well as younger males. I mean, these are things that not exclusively, but these are things that you profile to find your best, the most likely candidate.
That's former Republican Senator Rick Santorum in a presidential debate in 2011.
It's based on stereotypes.
Peter Schuck is a law professor at Yale. And while he does not support racial profiling, he does support profiling in some contexts. He says there's a difference.
We use stereotypes all the time, and life could not proceed unless we did use stereotypes, given our limited information and our need to make decisions.
By his definition, profiling means taking many factors into account when deciding who to single out, like clothing, age, gender, and yes, sometimes including race and national origin. One situation where Shuck thinks profiling makes sense is in airports.
There are thousands of people walking through the airport, and they're trying to find a needle in a haystack, and that's very, very difficult to do. So it would be surprising if they didn't rely to some extent on the person's appearance or the ethnic generalizations that are applied to people from that region.
The public has also been more tolerant of profiling in this situation. But Shuck only advocates for using profiling as a way to single people out for questioning.
And then engage in a conversation with him or her and obtain more information about that individual. And then after that, they don't have to and shouldn't rely on profiling.
But psychologist Jack Glaser says even using profiling in a restrained way can have a high social cost.
I don't think we should underestimate the stigmatizing, stressful, disenfranchising, and alienating experience of being subjected to extra scrutiny because of one's group membership.
Glaser believes we need to standardize police work as much as possible.
Wherever practicable, reduce the discretion of officers in their determinations of who's suspicious and who they should be subjecting to differential law enforcement.
Reversing the deeply ingrained stereotypes in our heads is really difficult, maybe impossible. But creating safeguards and learning to recognize our biases could keep us from using those stereotypes in destructive ways. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Natalie Jones.
I'm Janan Ismail, sitting in for John Perry, who's away this week, and to whom we send a warm hello. But I am here with Ken Taylor.
And today we're talking about racial profiling and implicit bias. We're joined now by Linda Alcoff. She's a professor of philosophy at the City University of New York. She's author of Visible Identities, Race, Gender, and the Self. Linda, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Ken.
Linda, you write about epistemology and existentialism, but a lot of your work focuses on issues of race and gender. What got you interested in these kinds of questions?
Well, I grew up in the South during the Civil Rights Movement. And I came to the South when I was a small child from Panama, where I was born. My father's Panamanian and my mother's Irish-American. And then when they divorced, my sister and I came to Florida and grew up. So, you know, I had a multiracial background. I was observing sort of conventions of behavior in the South, which were quite interesting, and the resistance to those conventions. So that really led to my interest.
When Ken and I were talking earlier, we were trying to figure out exactly what the problem with racial profiling is. So Ken suggests it was because it relies on unconscious stereotypes. But are all racial stereotypes harmful, or is it okay sometimes to generalize about a group of people based on race or ethnicity?
Yes, of course it is. I agree with you. I mean, I think there's true generalizations and there's false generalizations, and there's contexts in which it's okay to generalize and contexts in which you really shouldn't. You should just look at individuals. Individual characteristics.
Yeah, look, there are true generalizations, Linda. Blacks occupy so many, they are in prison more frequently than whites for this or that crime. There are true generalizations about health and all that, but those aren't stereotypes. Those are true generalizations. What's the difference between a stereotype and a true generalization? I'd like to know.
Well, one way people talk about it is, you know, a stereotype is taking one particular characteristic of a person or a group to sort of represent their, you know, their main features or essential features. So you're not really giving a full, you know, characterization of the group or the group's history or characteristics. You're just sort of focusing on one element. And then they're just sort of tagged by that one element. I don't use the term stereotype as, you know, interchangeable with generalization myself. I think stereotype brings in a process of bad judgment and bad reasoning. beyond what we normally do and correctly do when we, you know, use generalizations.
So generalizations can be sometimes good. I mean, there are many true ones. Not sure about good stereotypes, but we'll have to dig into that. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about racial profiling and implicit bias with Linda Alcoff from the City University of New York.
Why do we stereotype people based on race and ethnicity? Is it a result of unconscious biases? And if they're unconscious, are we responsible for them?
Race, racial stereotypes, and implicit bias, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues. Examining Ethics is a new podcast hosted by Andrew Cullison that tackles many of the ethical questions, large and small, we face in our everyday lives. You can subscribe for free on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast, or listen online at examiningethics.org.
Brown, stick around, but as you black, oh brother, get back.
Do our implicit biases make it impossible not to profile black, brown, and white people? If so, why is that? I'm Janann Ismail, sitting in for John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're talking about racial profiling and implicit bias.
Our guest is Linda Alcoff, author of Visible Identities, Race, Gender, and the Self. You can join Linda for a live chat at our online community of thinkers this coming Friday, October 10th at 12 noon Pacific. Be a part of the online chat at philosophytalk.org.
Linda, now, if we want to tackle this problem of racial profiling, harmful stereotyping, and implicit bias and all that, let's see if we can figure out where this stuff comes from in the first place. So what do you think? How do we develop these racist and homophobic and genderish stereotypes? Where do these things come from?
Well, I think, you know, from our material environment and our experience and our culture, you know, film, television, education experiences that people have. But I think sometimes it can be really misleading to talk about it as just sort of the, as if it's an automatic, you know, response mechanism produced by our environment over which we have no control. Because we do have, you know, sort of collective, we should take more collective control than we do of our, you know, sort of public environment. But also individually, we can, you know, choose what, you know, where to live, what courses to take, what newspapers to read, what information sources to seek out. We can have an impact on the environment that may trigger and, you know, change our associations between black and criminal, you know, those kinds of concepts.
So
I think we have to take some responsibility for the implicit biases that we may be harboring.
I take your point, but let's slow down a little bit. I mean, is it really just the media and culture and the uptake of that? I mean, part of me thinks, I mean, we distinguished earlier between sort of generalizations, legitimate generalizations, and stereotypes. But, you know, people just deal in stereotypes all the time, and they cognize the world. Birds fly. That's a stereotype. Not all birds fly. Penguins are birds, but they don't fly. The mind seems to be built to reason in terms of stereotypic kind of generalizations. So it's not, I mean, the propensity to do that, don't you think it's kind of inbuilt in human beings?
No, I think that's absolutely right. And we need it for our survival skills. I mean, you need to know how to navigate, you know, the world, your social world, your natural world, and you do it by figuring out what things are similar to what other things and what to expect from some new thing that you've never encountered before but kind of looks like something you have encountered before. So these are good mechanisms of judgment, but that doesn't mean that the way that we practice them in all cases is good. And, you know, I do think your point before about a racist society skewing the ways in which we, you know, judge what's similar to what, you know, it does have an effect. So
is part of the problem that it's not just that we're sort of observing statistical regularities in the environment and then using those statistical regularities to guide our sort of interaction with new cases. But it's partly that so much of our experience is experience that comes from the media, not actually statistical regulators in the environment, but warped and shaped by a kind of skewed representations of people that we see on media.
Yeah, I think that's really important to acknowledge. I mean, this new research on implicit bias that's come out in the last couple decades has been really important in philosophy, especially to sort of, you know, broaden out our ideas about how conscious we are when we engage in judging and knowing and things like that. But it can lead to the view that, you know, that we have no control over these things and we're not responsible for these things, or that the implicit judgments are just sort of automatic responses based on things that we see, as if things that we see are beyond our control or choice.
Can you describe some of the new research that you're referring to?
Well, the new research, I mean, the idea of implicit bias as sort of unconscious association has been around for a while, and what's been so fascinating about it for a lot of people is that you can have implicit biases that contradict your explicit moral and political values and commitments. You know, people in many cases have explicit commitments against racism and yet exhibit implicit racist biases. So it's blown a lot of people's minds to try to figure that out. But I think the idea that implicit bias is completely unconscious, completely inaccessible to us, that we can't control it, that we can't do anything about it, has led some people to think that the police who, you know, shoot Black and Latino men on such a regular basis due to racial profiling can't help it, that they're just either they individually are not culpable, or they're just making generalizations based on, you know, the criminal statistics. And I think neither of those claims is true according to the recent research.
Linda, I think you're making a really important point. I just want to underline it, because here's one of the things you could think. Here's one of the ways you might actually explain why police regularly get off for these kinds of, when they're accused of these kind of things, or why George Zimmerman was not convicted. Because look, you, in one way, given how he cognized the world from his cognitive frame, which let us admit might be set by implicit bias or something like that, but that's his cognitive frame. And within his cognitive frame, it's perfectly reasonable to distinguish the hoodie-wearing Black guy from the white guy sauntering along. I mean, it structures the world such that he's got reason to be more suspicious. And the law says, what would a reasonable person? Well, a reasonable person with what? With no frame at all, or with his frame? Once he's got that frame, he acts reasonably given that frame. So it might make it really hard for people to say, well, he did the wrong thing. Well, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that he has to be held accountable for the frame that he has. I think all of us have to. I don't think these things are just inevitable, because there's one of the things about the research on implicit bias is that motivation can have an effect. So you can change your implicit biases if they are in contradiction with, you know, if you have racist implicit biases, but you want to be a non-racist person, you can actually change your implicit bias with motivation, with a conscious effort. And so, you know, clearly George Zimmerman was not motivated to change his implicit biases. So he has to be accountable. But also, I think we have to think about accountability beyond the individual and really, you know, think of, especially with people like police and our justice system. I mean, those are institutions that are accountable to the public, and they should be accountable for the biases that they allow, institutionalize, excuse, and perpetrate.
Linda, I totally agree with you. I would not deny anything you just said. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about racial profiling and Implicit Bias with Linda Alcar from the City University of New York. And we'd love to have you join this conversation. And Butch in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Butch.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Okay, what's your comment or question?
I'm agreeing mostly with Linda. I just tuned in, like, randomly, and it got me a little bit incensed, so I had to call in. I think it's a little bit, I don't know, apologetic or something. What are we talking about? Why are we talking about this? It feels like we're apologizing. What am I saying, dude?
I don't know.
Like, dude, you have to think about the history of it. Like,
So, but let me ask you a question. You think we're apologizing? We're defending racial profiling? Is that what you think?
No. It's like in a fake way.
I think part of the interesting research that Linda was describing that might seem like it was partly apologizing or excusing racial profiling is this new research on implicit bias that explains why people do it and how, in some sense, it might not be conscious or something that they, in some sense, are morally responsible for. There are questions that are raised by that research, but certainly not answered by them.
Yeah, Butch, thanks for the call. I really want to say that we're not... See, look, this is a real phenomenon. It is a real... And my colleague, Jennifer Eberhardt at Stanford, just won a MacArthur Genius Grant for uncovering some of this stuff. I mean, this is deep and real and deeply problematic stuff. We're not really trying to apologize for it. We're actually trying to explore it and how it works and how it affects us, and we're trying to ask philosophical questions about it. So if you've got this unconscious bias that's operating to cause your behavior some way, because it doesn't just change your cognition, it causes you to behave in a certain way, what do we do about that? Do we hold people responsible for that or not? Or, I mean, I think these are hard questions, don't you, Linda?
Yeah, and I think the caller's right that people do use the research and use this kind of new terminology to make excuses. So I think he's picking up on that, even though I know none of the three of us want to go in that direction. But I think that the idea of, the term implicit leads some people to think that it's so below the surface, it's like an automatic reflex. That we have no control over it, and then there's no moral culpability or collective responsibility.
Right, and I bet you he tuned in just as I was saying. This probably explains why some juries are unwilling to convict police, because they see that's the cop's cognitive frame. The cop isn't responsible for his cognitive frame, and from his cognitive frame, he was acting reasonably. But so I put both to both of you. Are we responsible for the cognitive frames? I mean, doesn't society just throw these cognitive frames onto our brains? And are we really responsible for that?
Yes, I think we really are. We have to begin to, unpack what that means and how to create opportunities for people to become more responsible. I mean, if you have, the new research on explicit bias suggests that by far the majority of people don't want to be racist. So if they don't want to be racist, then we need to, really use this new research to help show us all how to be less racist and sexist. And there are ways to do it. I mean, you need both the opportunity of information and experiences that can alter your sense of, what's true about the social world and what's not true. And you need to have the motivation to seek out those opportunities that are available to you.
Right. I think one of the most fascinating things for me about that research was that there's a difference between holding racist beliefs and acting in racist ways. So when we use phrases like, none of us want to be racist, right. There's a distinction to be made there about between acting in racist ways and holding the racist beliefs, and the fact that those two don't go together, I think, is something that needs to be reflected on and understood properly in order to bring us around to not acting in racist ways, even if we don't hold racist beliefs.
We've got a caller in line, Mitt in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mitt.
Yeah, and it's Milt.
That's Milt, I'm sorry. I misread your name.
This is a statistical concern. There are more than 1 billion Muslims in the world. And for the sake of argument, let us exclude all women and men under 16 in men over 60. Let's say there's 400, 300 million Muslims left. How many people were actually known to commit acts of violence, Muslims, 9/11, or were definitely planning to in the United States? Let's call it 50, 60, 75. What percent of these people are compared to 400 million? That's a hugely small amount of people. How could you profile based on that enormously small percentage, all Muslims?
Yeah, well said, Milt. Linda, what do you say about that?
Well, yeah, in New York, you can imagine, we've had quite a lot of discussions about these issues. And, you know, I think it's clear one thing after, you know, 12-plus years of experience of trying to address terrorist threats, that the profiling doesn't work either for trying to find regular criminals or for people who might be engaged in terrorism. You need what they call old-fashioned police methods, where you actually get more evidence and more reason and, you know, more more reasons to go after or to somebody than simply their identity. It's a kind of laziness.
Yeah,
really.
Linda, not only is it laziness, it's very fallacious. Milt was brilliant. Let's take it just one step further. Suppose that every single crime in the United States was committed by one black man, then every crime would be committed by a black person. Does that make it so if you say who committed a crime, it's highly likely, it's 100% likely that a black person did it. But how likely is any given black person to have committed that crime? Hardly at all, right? So people make, and Milt was basically pointing this out, people make the error, and because people are, humans are bad statistical reasoners, people make the error of going from X was more likely committed to by a person of description X to people of description X are more likely to do that thing. That's just not a good inference. But the human mind is pretty messed up. That's the thing I get from this stuff, that the human mind is just a messed up thing. What do you guys think?
It's not that messed up. I have hope. I keep hope alive. But here's another idea. I mean, what kind of crime are we looking at when we let the police off the hook here? I was just on a grand jury, and it was very interesting the kinds of crimes that we were going after. Very petty, small potatoes, amounts of dollars types of crimes. We have a lot of crime in New York that happens on Wall Street. We have real estate developers. The real estate developer who built the building that I live in Brooklyn has, I don't know, $40,000 of legal charges against him by the city. It's been going on for years. Nothing has ever happened to him. He's just built a brand new, huge building in Brooklyn. So it's the kinds of crimes that we focus on. It's the kinds of criminals that we have at the front of our brains that also produces, you know, what we see and what we look for. I wish that we would begin to rethink about what are the most serious kinds of crimes. We would probably get very different kinds of stereotypes.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about racial profiling and implicit bias with Linda Alcoff from the City University of New York.
How do we solve the problem of racial profiling? Do we need new laws and new public policies? Or is it up to each individual to overcome their own implicit racial biases?
Putting a stop to racial profiling when Philosophy Talk continues. Examining Ethics, a new podcast hosted by Andrew Collison, takes on ethical questions with stories and deep discussion. You can subscribe to it on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts, or listen online at examiningethics.org.
To hate all the people your relatives hate, you've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be carefully taught.
Even if you're carefully taught not to racial profile, will your implicit biases still betray you? Sitting in for John Perry, I'm Janan Ismail. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Accept Your Intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Linda Alcoff, author of Visible Identities, Race, Gender, and the Self. Linda will be part of a live chat at our online community of thinkers this coming Friday, October 10th at 12 noon Pacific time. I hope you can join us at philosophytalk.org. We've got a caller on the line, Martha in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Martha. What's your comment or question?
Hi, Linda and Ken. I want to talk about the encounter on the street. I'm a middle-aged white woman. I wish not to be a racist. I acknowledge that I may have some racism built in, and I want to. What I think of as a weed puller. But look, let's take the most prejudicial image that rises in people's minds: the tough-looking guy that wearing gang colors or hoodies or all this stuff. You know, he looks like an older teenager. He's got the expression, the walk, all this junk. Okay, mental image. I want to do a couple thought experiments out loud. Change the costume to an L.L. Bean preppy look. Same reaction? I don't think so. I don't get the same reaction. Second thought experiment. Change the age of the guy to an old fart. Same reaction? I don't think so. Change, again, the whole costume again, the whole gang or tough guy costume. Change it to a girl. Same reaction?
So, Martha, are you trying to... you're making a point. I am. You're building it as a... What is it?
What I'm reacting to is not that that person is black. I think what I'm reacting to is the attitude, body language, expression, and costume of toughness. Because I can change in my mind that image to all kinds of things that are still black. An old man, a young woman, a preppy-dressed young black man, a young black man with a very different expression on his face and a very different body language. And I don't have the visceral reaction,
Martha,
that may be prejudicial.
Martha, I take your point, but I want to add something. I want to tell you something about some of this research. This is a recent one. There's a guy, his first name I think was Jose. And he applied for a bunch of jobs, and he sent his resume all over the place, and he got no reaction. He took off one letter, and his name became Joe rather than Jose. And you know what? The applications flooded in. All these studies show same information, same appearance, change one factor. Just the race or whatever, or the gender, change just one fact, everything else the same. All this implicit bias stuff is built on that. It tracks a single factor. I mean, that's what the research shows over and over and over again. Linda, what do you think about that?
Well, yeah, I think that I was thinking in the cases that she brought up, that if she's a middle-class white woman, that's the way she identifies herself. You know, she's not really at threat from people who are in gangs anyway. I mean, most of the crime is poor people on poor people, right, in poor neighborhoods. So, you know, the idea that certain kinds of clothing is going to be a reliable indicator that she herself is at threat from somebody, it's just factually false.
Right. And I think, you know, the people that are wearing those clothing and explicitly sending cues that they are to be afraid of are sending it to other gang members, not to her. I think that's exactly
right.
But actually, let me ask you, Linda, what steps do you think need to be taken to eliminate racial profiling?
Well, I think, you know, one of the other unfortunate collateral effects of the critique of racial profiling has, you know, you might think that the converse of racial profiling is something like colorblindness, which has, you know, been around as an idea for a long time in the United States as the proper anti-racist way to be. And I think that's really done a disservice to us. I think the ideal of colorblindness or absolute neutrality or not seeing or hearing what you see or hear before you in any full and rich sense, I mean, I think it's just done a disservice to our thinking about how to get to a better place on these questions. Because I think that the solution is not to, and then, you know, when people like claim neutrality or claim objectivity or claim to not see color, to see, you know, they don't know whether you're purple or green. It doesn't matter to them. You hear people say things like that. It makes them less self-reflective and less self-conscious and
so
less
motivated. What do you think then? I
mean, motivated.
What is the solution then?
Well, I think it's all of the above. I think that individuals can take individual steps to discover and find out more about our own implicit biases, what they're based on, and
are there sort of concrete, specific suggestions that you would give for people?
Well, I think, you know, seeking out I think U.S. history is like just so incredibly important and useful here. There's a great website called historyisaweapon.com that you can use. It has a lot of free sources. Just finding out what the truth is about the history of the community that we live in changes your thinking.
Linda, I want to suggest to Janann that this is a really hard problem. There are no, like, I'm going to do this myself kind of solutions. This work on implicit bias, I think this is revolutionary work in a certain way, because it shows us that even those of us who are self-conscious, look, even women who are feminists have implicit biases toward women, right? Even left-leaning progressive have implicit biases toward the black, Hispanic, other. And you might not have thought that, right? But psychology is showing us that there is so much that goes on in our minds. So the first step is to be aware of how complicated a human mind is, right? And I don't think we have been aware of that until very recently.
But are you suggesting, Ken, that maybe it's not an individual solution, but there's at least concrete, specific things we can do at the collective level to solve the problem?
You know,
or do you think there's no solution
at all? I'm kind of pessimistic. I think we are now, a solution is at least conceivable because we're more aware of how the mind really works. As cognitive science progresses, we learn more and more about how the mind really works, and how to ameliorate it is not a simple thing. I don't know if there are. I mean, I think some ameliorative projects would be a darn good thing. How they would work, I don't really know.
Linda, what do you think about that?
Well, I think we need individual and collective and institutional and educational. I mean, Ken's right. We need a revolution. I was reading in the New York Times about Andre Breyer, you know, one of the great actors of our generation, who was talking about how many scripts he just throws in the garbage because they just offer him these very stereotyped one-dimensional representations of black men to play. I mean, we've got to look at our public culture. I think we can affect education. It's a big fight. We can affect police training. We can counsel more individual responsibility, but we also need to look at our public culture.
I'm going to take one last caller, Richard in San Francisco. Be brief. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. A few minutes ago, you posed a very interesting hypothetical question. What if it happened that all crimes were committed by one person who happened to be black? And then you mentioned all kinds of bad deductions that people could make and would make in such a case. But it gets tricky because then there's the other side, too. At that point, it would be very logical in airport screening, for example, to only screen black people. It would be a waste of time to screen white people, because you knew that the one person committing all the crime was this person who happened to be black. And you could take what I just said and extend that to, what if it turns out that more crimes are committed by Middle Eastern black men or Middle Eastern brown men? And it gets tricky.
Yeah, that's true. It does get tricky.
Actually, I'm not sure it does. If 20 Muslim men are going through an airport security to every white person, and Muslim men are only 20 times more likely than white people to commit crimes, then it would make equal sense that you should screen every Muslim person and every white person going through the screening checkpoint.
Yeah, but Linda, I'm going to give you the last word because we're down to what's your final thought here?
Well, I think we also have to rethink what we're screening for, you know, whether it's the petty crime or it's the huge white-collar crime that produces so much poverty and inequality and then exacerbates racism, et cetera. So I think we need to improve our processes, but we also need to improve our goals.
Yeah, I mean, nobody profiles would-be tax frauds, would-be inside traders, right? No, why don't we do that? They do lots of damage. Is that part of white privilege? The white privilege not to be racially profiled.
Well, and this whole language about inevitability, you know, well, they do good things, they develop, and so I think they're let off the hook. I'm not sure that they do good things.
Isn't it partly, though, too? I mean, it's foremost in our mind, the things that we're most afraid of, and we're more afraid of violent crime than, I think, of white-collar crime.
Well, depends on who the we is right?
Yeah.
Well, that's a well-taken point. Linda, this has been a fascinating conversation. This is really eye-opening research, this stuff on implicit bias, and racial profiling is a big problem. We've only scratched the surface, but with scratching the surface, I'm going to thank you for helping us scratch it so well.
And thank you, Linda. Really, it's been fascinating.
Glad to be here.
Our guest has been Linda Alcoff. She's a professor of philosophy at the City University of New York. She's author of Visible Identities, Race, Gender, and the Self. This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And you can join us in the community this coming Friday, October 10th at 12 noon Pacific for a live online chat with today's guest, Linda Alcoff. Now, biased and proud of it, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, I don't follow gender politics that much because I'm an old straight guy and I don't really have a dog in that hunt, if you follow me. Then a few months back, I came across the term cisgender, which is slang, well, not really slang, a descriptive term for a type of gender identity. Your experience of your own gender matches the sex you were assigned at birth. So things have become so complicated in gender politics that I, a straight man, along with straight women, lesbians, and gay men, are part of the same group. People believe they are what their organs say they are. This might seem strangely normative, but it is weird gender politically because transgender folks don't feel that way at all. Cisgender is supposed to be a value-neutral term, but I don't know. Cis is Latin for same side as and is intended as an antonym of trans. Does that mean that cisgender is some kind of ipso facto oppressor class? Isn't that kind of gender profiling? Well, there is the notion of cisgender privilege society provides for you, cisgender-specific bathrooms, for instance. And if their driver's license says they are male or female, the cisgender don't have to prove it. They can sign up for bank accounts, travel to foreign lands, and apply for work without worrying about transphobic harassment. Well, okay, but when someone chides me, check your privilege, how am I supposed to do that? Am I supposed to feel bad about not feeling bad about not caring about my sexuality one way or another? If I am cisgendered, how is that a privilege? That's just the way it is, just the way you are, trans or not trans or gay. And speaking of which, hang on, if cisgendered is the oppressor class, are we supposed to think that gay men, who, lest we forget, have been mocked, beaten, and murdered by straight men, are oppressors right alongside straight men? When do we all start getting together on this? This stuff gets fraught real quick. I just read that trans person Justin Vivian Bond, profiled in New York Magazine, was outraged that the magazine had referred to Bond as he rather than Bond's preferred pronoun, the. And for writers not wanting to use he, she, or it, we often get lost in a forest of thems and those. Dan Savage, the sex advice columnist and very out gay man, got in trouble in 2003 when he used the word tranny in one of his columns. Here in San Francisco, there was a famous bar for drag performers called Tranny Shack. I don't know if the name's been changed or not. World-famous drag queen RuPaul has said, I love the word tranny. Now, queer went from an insult to a badge of pride in the blink of an eye. Maybe tranny will go through the same thing. I read an interview with Dan Savage in The Guardian. He said, quote, something that I think has hampered trans awareness and the trans movement is that many don't want to identify as trans. Transitioning is something they did. If they're binary, they identify as male or female, and they're done, unquote. I never thought of that, but it kind of makes sense. If your whole life is geared to transitioning into this new gender once you've made the passage, why would you look back? For many, it's not about the journey, it's getting where you want to go. Speaking from my perch of privilege, of course, where I end my journey, totally entitled to my opinion and my sense of entitlement. Hey, I earned it, man. I gotta go.
Philosopher's Corner.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Carola Kreitmeier, Jimmy Tobin, Jill Covington, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
I know this isn't comfortable, but if you don't want to be associated with white-collar crime, maybe you shouldn't dress that way.
Hey, you made it to the end of the show. Not everybody does.
That means you must really like us. So help us. How can you help us?
Go to philosophytalk.org, look for the I Will Help button, click it, and get ready to help.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you so much for donating.